¿Está preparada, señorita?
Sí. Sí, maestro.
From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa. 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education, we visit a school that's still struggling to remain integrated.
I have a daughter in another public school that is much more, I would say, segregated, but also a public school. And this PS 133 really stands out in the way that it really reflects, you know, the diversity you see around.
And we meet undocumented students fighting to qualify for in-state tuition.
I'm not asking for financial aid. I'm not asking for loans. I'll pay it on my own. Just let me pay what's right.
In our report card show, we look at the trouble with statistics and we see which TV networks represented Latinos best this season. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa. In May, Americans commemorated the 60th anniversary of a landmark ruling in American history, Brown versus Board of Education. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that racial segregation of children had no place in American schools. Brown opened the door for lawsuits demanding the integration of schools, mostly in the American South. But 9 years later, President Kennedy found himself having to use the National Guard to enforce that ruling.
Following a series of threats and defiant statements, the presence of Alabama National Guardsmen was required on the University of Alabama to carry out the final and unequivocal order of the United States District Court of the Northern District of Alabama. That order called for the admission of two clearly qualified young Alabama residents who happened to have been born Negro.
1 year later, the Civil Rights Act became law, and it paved the way for desegregation in places besides schools. At the time, though, Latinos were not considered a discriminated group like African Americans. That changed in 1972.
Petitioner's submission is that the Denver system has violated the constitutional rights of black and Hispano children to equal protection of the laws, and that the courts below should have required a more comprehensive plan to desegregate the schools and otherwise eliminate discrimination.
That's a clip of the oral argument session at the Supreme Court in Keyes versus School District 1. In that decision, the court said the Hispanics had the same desegregation rights as African Americans. The court found that Latinos, mostly Mexican Americans, in fact, had a long history of discrimination. Integration in American schools peaked in the 1980s, but numbers began to slip again after the Supreme Court issued new rulings that made it harder to claim racial segregation in schools.
The separation of cities and suburbs for desegregation purposes by the Supreme Court in 1974 was tragic. So was the Supreme Court's decision that there was no right to an equal education in the American Constitution in the Rodriguez case from San Antonio. So the Supreme Court has been a colossal failure in recognizing the need to address the Latino issues.
Gary Orfield is a researcher with the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. And what he has to say is borne out in the data. Most studies say children are now more divided by race, income, and housing than they were in the 1970s. There are now 5 times the number of Latinos in public schools, and that number may make you think there is more integration. But Latinos tend to concentrate in low-income areas with low-quality schools.
Most of the people who are coming across the border from Mexico and Central America are poor and with an elementary education. They're coming into a society where the opportunities for people with that level of preparation are dismal.
Orfield says that now, 8 in 10 Latinos in the U.S. go to a school that is mostly Latino or black and poor.
If we went all out for integration, we couldn't do it all now because of the demography.
According to UCLA's Civil Rights Project, the states where Latinos are most segregated are California, Texas, and surprisingly, New York. Yes, in the Big Apple, Latino and Black students are likely to go to so-called apartheid schools, where less than 10% of students are white.
New York is a place that has always had the conceit that it's liberal and progressive. They sent volunteers down to reform the South, but they don't realize they've been behind the South now for 40 years.
60 years after Brown, should Americans be worried about how segregated our schools are? Here's Latino USA's senior producer, AC Valdez.
It's 8 in the morning, and parents are dropping off their kids at PS 133. There's white, Black, and Latino moms and dads crossing each other at the school door. There's Latinos that don't speak English.
Bueno, yo tengo solo tengo dos días trayéndolo. Entonces no tengo experiencia como para decirte.
He's the uncle of one of the students. And white parents, like Kyle Krinka. He's glad his son comes here.
I have a daughter in another public school that is much more, I would say, segregated, but also a public school. And this PS 133 really stands out in the way that it really reflects, you know, the diversity you see around.
That's because PS 133 is an exception in the Big Apple. In New York City, Black and Latino students are very likely to go to schools that are also just Black and Latino. PS 133 is in Park Slope in Brooklyn. The neighborhoods have been middle class for decades, but in the last 10 years, housing prices have skyrocketed. And some parents are having trouble with the change, like Dominican-American Robert, who was in too much of a rush to give us his last name.
And they kind of make you feel uncomfortable now, like as if you don't belong, like an elitist type thing going on.
No matter the differences, all parents agree that the principal at least listens to everyone.
My name is Heather Foster Mann, and I have been the principal of PS 133 for the last 7 years. This is my 8th year, actually.
The school was revamped as the neighborhood began to change. They got a new building at a new location. So the two school districts in the area began fighting over who would run PS 133. There was fear that the new, affluent parents would completely take over the school. So the community, some parents, and the school's administrators fought back against the apparent takeover.
And it was really important to us that the school didn't all of a sudden change overnight. And so children who lived in lower socioeconomic housings, that they would have equal access to the school.
Ms. Fosterman and some parents negotiated with the city's Department of Education to let the school be a choice school for students in the two districts. They also negotiated an admissions target. At least 35% of school admissions would have to be reserved for low-income students and for English language learners.
I mean, this whole process took about 2 to 3 years just to really work out, you know, all the parts, all the moving parts. And, you know, we're the first school, I believe, in New York City that has embarked on such a monumental admissions policy.
The Parent Teacher Association has become more diverse. The board is made up of 3 white and 2 African-American women. We met 3 of them in the hallway. They really like the school's diversity.
Yes, so I think it's the best. I think the school should reflect the diversity of the city.
That's Lorraine Letac, yes. Vice president of the PTA board. We asked them how integrated the school was. Kate Dotrich, another vice president, weighed in.
The kids are totally integrated, and I think for us, we often don't have contact with upper grades.
But Letac says they're doing something about it.
Yeah, I think that's the role of, I guess, the PTA to try to create some events and try, like, mixer for diversity.
Common project
that makes everybody get together.
Ahmed Dickerson, or Mr. D, is the parent coordinator. He's been at the school for almost 20 years now. He remembers what the school was like a few years ago.
I want to say it was 90% Hispanic families in our school, and, you know, 10% African-Americans and 1% of Caucasian in our school community.
Now the school has 161 Latino, 170 African-American, and 120 Caucasians. And demographics are not the only thing that changed.
When I first started here, we was very low in parents' involvement. My role is to try to get parents more involved. Today is a big turnout when it comes to parent involvement.
The new PTA now has a committee for pretty much everything, from fundraising to gardening. They've raised money for special arts and leadership programs, even a new website. And it's the new parents that started the dual language program, the school's most popular offering. Mr. Dickerson took us on a tour of the classes. We started with the lower grades.
So these are our two French classrooms. This is the English part, and this is the French part.
The classes are half English dominant and half French dominant children.
Can you sing for me the escargot song?
We noticed that most of the children here were white. Were things different in the Spanish language classrooms? No. Now, the kids here were pretty good at pronouncing the sounds of Spanish. But again, the classroom was mostly white. We went up the stairs in the building to see the upper levels, where the fourth and fifth graders were.
And you guys are fifth grade class. Seniors. General ed, yes.
Here, the change was astonishing. The majority of students were Black and Latino. School administrators say they haven't been able to bring more Black and Latino families into the special language programs. The Department of Education now runs admissions to PS 133 and to the special programs. So it's hard for them to tell how many Black and brown students are applying.
The problem that we're finding is that the targets only work as well as our ability to reach out to the community, and that there are parts of the community that are not fully engaged in, you know, being a part of the school in terms of us, you know, getting certain, you know, families into the door. But it's a strong commitment of the school to maintain that diversity.
That's Sarah Voisin. She's one of the parents that works with Mr. Dickerson doing outreach to the low-income communities. She says coming to the school is especially hard for low-income Latino and Black families. Getting the kids to the school from far places in the two districts costs money and time for families that are already struggling. She says the city should be doing more, like providing busing to and from the school for low-income children and their parents.
So it's a great school, but how we negotiate those types of structural barriers are, those are our challenges.
We tried asking the city's Department of Education how they were helping the school reach its target, and what options are available to help schools like this one bring in low-income children and their parents. But we didn't receive a reply. So in September, PS 133 will have a new incoming class. It's only then they'll know if the diversity they're aiming for is here to stay, or if it's just a brief stop on the way to good old New York City segregation. For Latino USA, I'm senior producer A.C. Valdez. Thanks to producer Camilo Vargas for his reporting on this piece.
Coming up on Latino USA...
After the Minnesota Dream Act passed, my mom, she's been able to come home at 4 and she's been able to have dinner with us.
What in-state tuition looks like in real life to undocumented students. Stay with us, no se vayan, on our report card show.
Dijo que yo era retrasado. Mi mamá se lo creyó, pobre casi se murió. Menos mal estaba equivocado. Luego fui creciendo, me puse inteligente en el colegio, estaba un año adelantado. No había más que hacer que estar ahí sentado. Qué fácil era antes llegar volando hasta el planeta Marte, atravesando el cielo en una nave dibujada. Si no te despertaste después de que vinieron a avisarte.
Solo quiero trabajar.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The school year is wrapping up, so we're bringing you our report card. And when it comes to making education accessible for the thousands of undocumented students that live here, 23 out of 50 states get an E for effort. They offer in-state college tuition to undocumented students, often through their own version of the DREAM Act. So, what does that mean? It means lower high school dropout rates, more stable families, and big business. In the case of Florida, where a bill recently passed allowing in-state tuition for undocumented students, immigrant business owners brought in over $13 billion, yes, billion with a B, dollars in revenue in 2010 alone. But on a personal level, the ability to get in-state tuition means much more. So we asked a few people to tell us how they feel about it. First, we hear from 17-year-old Diego Ramirez of Homestead, Florida.
I'm always being a school kid. I like going to school. Seeing that my brother, he graduated from high school, but he wasn't able to continue going to college. But then when my sister graduated, I was already on 10th grade, and I was like, why doesn't she do the same thing? I was like, why does she continue education? At first, I thought it was just because I didn't want to. But then I realized that it wasn't because of that. It was because of my status of undocumented students. In that moment, I was like, wow, now I understand why my brother did what he did, what my sister did, what she did. And I'm like, I was mad with myself for being undocumented. Why would I be mad with myself for being something that I didn't choose to be? I wanted to be involved in it. I wanted to be part of something that might going to change the future of a lot of students. Then when it comes to opportunity, like we're going to Tallahassee to talk about the bill and stuff like that, I was really excited about it. I was very passionate about it because it's something that I wanted to do. It was something that I wanted to help other people, not only myself, but others. Now I'll be able to afford college, living better, and do my best to keep on going for my dream. I won't stop.
My name is Anyati Flores. I am a student at Metropolitan State University. I'm majoring in social science and minoring in history. I want to go to law school. Every morning, I wake up at 7 and take a 3-hour bus ride over to Metropolitan State. I live in Plymouth, Minnesota. My family's from Xochapan, Morelos in Mexico. I'm an undocumented student. I've been in the United States since I was 1.5. My parents wanted us, me and my sister, to go to college. I've always wanted to be a lawyer. My mom and dad were ready to pay for it. But then my dad lost his job and my mom ended up having to do it on her own. She would work Monday through Sunday from 4 a.m. in the morning till like 6. So it was difficult for my family and I. Like this month, for instance, we have $200 in our bank account. The Minnesota Dream Act has helped a lot. The Minnesota Dream Act gives in-state tuition and a grant to the Dreamers. After the Minnesota Dream Act passed, my mom, she's been able to come home at 4 and she's been able to have dinner with us.
My name is Renato Olmedo Gonzalez. I'm 23 years old. I just turned 23. I moved here to Salt Lake City, Utah when I was 15 from Guadalajara. So in-state tuition has allowed me to continue my education here in Utah, and it has made a difference in the way that I don't have to pay. First, I don't have to pay 3 times as much as out-of-state tuition. And also, it's a reaffirmation that I'm a Utah student. I'm a local student. I live here. It also has allowed me to pursue that education that I always knew I wanted to have. For me, I went to Utah High School. I went to public school here. And education, upper education, higher education was always a possibility to me. I never ruled it out or I never considered it a luxury. I never saw myself different than my classmates, than the kids I went to high school with. And even though I wasn't born here in Utah, this is my United States. We have pretty much the same experience in the public school system and upper education. And that's how I see in-state tuition being beneficial to me and also reaffirming my sense of place and sense of belonging to the state, to Utah.
That was Diego Ramirez from Florida, Zignazzi Flores from Minnesota, and Renato Olmedo Gonzalez from Utah. telling us what in-state tuition has meant to them. Not all states are following the trend of offering in-state tuition to undocumented immigrants. There are a handful that bar them from even enrolling at some state universities. Take Georgia. There, undocumented students are suing the state, demanding the opportunity to pay in-state tuition at its public universities. LEU brings us the story.
Up with education!
Down, down with segregation! Up with education!
On the steps of the Fulton County Courthouse in Atlanta, a couple of dozen students are holding a rally.
These young men and women around me, who are products of our state's educational system, they need in-state tuition now.
That's 20-year-old Raymond Partolin.
This injustice has to end right now.
Partolin is one of 39 students suing the Georgia university system. State policy bars undocumented students from paying in-state tuition rates, even if they have Georgia residency. Partolin says he's one of the lucky ones. He got a scholarship to a private university, but he says that's exactly why he joined the lawsuit, because luck's not enough.
If it weren't for Mercer, I wouldn't be in college.
Mercer University's campus is here in Macon, Georgia, a city Partolin says is the song and soul of the South. It's where he grew up and where he considers home.
I love Georgia. I love the culture and everything. I love sweet tea and peach cobbler and barbecue and soul food and country music.
He even has the Georgia State motto, the words wisdom, justice, and moderation, tattooed on his back. Partolin was brought to the U.S. from the Philippines when he was a year old. His parents overstayed their visas. In high school, he had a 4.0 GPA, but the anxiety of being undocumented gripped him.
Just thinking about how hard I worked and to think that it wouldn't go anywhere, I wouldn't be able to go to school because of my immigration status, it was completely disappointing. In my second semester of my junior year of high school, I tried to kill myself.
Without in-state tuition, college is usually out of reach for students like Partolin. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, Georgia is one of five states that explicitly bars undocumented students from getting it. Georgia is also one of three states, along with Alabama and South Carolina, that bans those students from even enrolling in some public universities. 22-year-old Nayeli Quesada is also a plaintiff in the suit. She graduated from a Georgia high school in 2009.
I remember graduation. I was so upset. I mean, I did not feel like wearing the cap and gown because I was like, what's next? All these people are so excited to go into something so much better.
Quesada started off working in a fast food restaurant. Then she found out about Freedom University, an underground school for students without legal status. Through the guidance of the volunteer professors there, she says she knew she wanted to go to college again.
I'm not asking for financial aid. I'm not asking for loans. I'll pay it on my own. Just let me pay what's right.
The students are suing the state because they want to go to college. It's really simple.
That's Charles Cook, the attorney representing the plaintiffs.
Every one of these kids, all 39 of them, have graduated from Georgia high schools. They graduated with good enough grades to get into many of the best colleges in Georgia.
In 2010, the Georgia Board of Regents adopted a rule that would only grant in-state tuition to those who had what's called lawful presence. In 2012, President Obama's Deferred Action Program for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, brought the issue front and center. Cook says, according to the Department of Homeland Security, DACA students now have lawful presence. But supporters of Georgia's in-state tuition ban say that lawful presence was really intended to mean legal status. Legal status sets someone on a pathway to getting a green card or citizenship. That's different from lawful presence, and it's something deferred action students technically don't have.
Yeah, it's rather like asking whether or not I'm bald or without hair.
D.A. King is the president of the Dustin Inman Society, a pro-enforcement watchdog group.
All that this DACA program has done is to defer deportation proceedings. They are still illegal aliens.
He says if the case were to come out in favor of the students, the next thing you'd see is the students being able to get state financial aid.
And it just goes right down the line on how much can we reward illegal immigration?
He says American taxpayers shouldn't have to foot the bill. Back at the courthouse, the students aren't backing down. Raymond Partolin says he hopes the case will be a turning point for his state.
But something that I don't like about Georgia sometimes is the fact that it can be so backwards sometimes. And it's disappointing, but that doesn't mean I love this state any less.
Even if the case does end in favor of in-state tuition, the state university system could change its policy. It could require its students to have legal status instead of lawful presence, fencing out those with deferred action. That would mean one more hurdle on their quest to go to college. For Latino USA, I'm Ellie Yu in Atlanta, Georgia.
National estimates say fewer than 70% of Latinos and African Americans graduate high school. In Austin, Texas, there's a charter school dedicated solely to teaching dropouts and helping them to graduate. But the state says the school doesn't meet academic and financial standards and wants to close it down. From Radio Bilingüe, Joy Diaz has more.
Debbie Ratcliffe is a spokesperson with the Texas Education Agency, or TEA. She says the state's new law is pretty clear. Among other things, it gave TEA teeth to revoke the licenses of failing charter schools.
If a school has received the state's lowest either academic or financial rating for 3 straight years, it automatically is closed.
6 schools throughout the state are failing.
American Youth Works.
One of them is American Youth Works, one of the few charters nationwide that specializes in helping dropout kids graduate.
You're welcome.
Park Smith is American Youth Works CEO, and he says his school is pretty atypical.
We get them to catch up and move on to post-secondary education or to career pathways.
Smith says unconventional students require unconventional teaching methods. For instance, it takes some of his students 6, 7, or even 10 years to graduate.
This is not your typical classroom. We have rocking chairs where the mothers can sit with their baby if they're nursing in that moment. We have carpets and toys for the children.
The classroom is an example of American Youth Work's successes. Out of the 12 teen moms enrolled in the program this year, 8 will graduate on time and 1 will graduate early. Now, the Texas Education Agency is aware of some of the successes American Youth Works has had over the last 30-plus years, but Ratcliffe is not impressed.
Well, there's rarely a school that's completely bad. There's always some bright spot.
But the state agency does not focus on schools' bright spots. Instead, it takes points off for each of the charter's failures. In the case of American Youth Works, CEO Smith explains the school lost points for another campus it owned before.
We had a negative academic mark for a campus that we chose to close ourselves back in 2010.
The education agency also believes the school has too many teachers per student ratio. And lastly, the state says the school is failing financially.
This whole issue boils down to basically $7.62.
In order to understand what Smith is saying, it's worth mentioning that the TEA tells schools where it's okay to invest their money and where it isn't. That's because in the past, schools have lost money. But for years, American Youth Works invested in programs that paid more than what TEA allows. The school says at times, they made almost 1,000 times more than what they would have made had they invested in a TEA-approved account.
So in the end, we could be shut down over $7.62 worth of interest when instead we earned $7,000. Something is wrong with this measurement tool.
Smith now invests into TEA-approved accounts. He says the school is correcting all of its wrongs. But so far, the state is still pursuing closure. So the school is doing everything it can to prevent that from happening. First, it's appealing through the court system. Then, it's encouraging current and former students to become some sort of school ambassadors. One of these ambassadors is Ruben Castro Jr. He graduated from American Youth Works 14 years ago.
We're building a 5-star rated solar subdivision equipped with rainwater.
Castro is a construction manager for La Casa Verde, a greenhouse building company. Like the majority of students at American Youth Works,
I think I'm happy. I know I'm happy where I'm at right now.
Now, Castro has become a mentor to other kids at American Youth Works. He's even hired a couple of them. And he sees his old self in them. He remembers how he, too, wanted to give up and drop out of school. Castro and many of the school's current students and teachers hope the agency chooses another option for the school. Now, it's up to the courts. If the courts rule in favor of the state, the school will close its doors by the end of this school year.
That story came to us from Radio Bilingüe reporter Joy Diaz. And now, making the grade in an upcoming film called First Generation. It's a documentary directed by husband and wife team Adam and Jane Fenderson and narrated by Blair Underwood. The film follows four high school students across California, all from different backgrounds and with different family situations. There's a football player from Los Angeles, a Samoan dancer and drummer from South Central, a waitress from Northern California, and the daughter of a deported migrant worker in Bakersfield. In the documentary, we watch as these students navigate the complicated world of college applications, because all of them are trying to become the first members of their families to go to college. In this scene, the students are preparing for the SATs, a test that comes with lots of pressure for any student, but that pressure is compounded if your parents have never taken it.
As junior year was coming to an end, the college admissions process was just beginning. Step one, take the SAT.
Tell you the truth, the SAT was the hardest test I ever took in my life. Like, I seen words I didn't even know how to pronounce, how to say. So I'm going to try to take the SAT as much as I can so I can get a good score.
I think I did pretty well on the writing portion of it. That wasn't very hard. But I don't know. We'll see when my scores come.
I'm taking the SAT test. That's coming in June 7th. I feel confident because just like any other test, all I got to do is just like pray to God and stuff to help me, like, trying to pass this test.
I'm taking the SAT and ACT. I've heard that they're really hard, and I want to score lots of points so I can, like, get accepted to a good college.
Every year, colleges talk about how much more competitive they were than the year before, and so that anxiety around test prep is feeding this frenzy of how much test prep I can get and how much more my scores can go up.
Low-income students don't have access to these test prep classes, and they tend to do worse on the SAT on average.
In fact, if you look at the national averages, as family income goes up from $20,000 to over $200,000 a year, students' SAT scores directly correlate to how much their families make.
That's not because the kids, rich kids, are smarter. It's because of the opportunities that students have.
Starting this fall, the documentary First Generation will be screening across the country. Check out latinousa.org for a link to their website. And coming up on Latino USA...
Well, there's kind of a saying that's been floating around for many decades that says there are lies, damned lies, and statistics.
We do the numbers, looking at where you're led and sometimes misled by the media and what it means if you're Latino. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Watch the condos build up around the subway stop. Why the window next door filled with cinder blocks? Who's down on the trash heaps and empty lots? Indifferent to the wildfire around the plot. Watch the faces get lighter as the seasons change. Reflect the architecture being rearranged. Now the real estate agents call it different names, like no one is the wiser.
Eyes wide open, eyes wide shut.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And as the school year ends, we're thinking a lot about report cards. And I'm willing to bet that your least favorite class was math. Well, don't feel bad. It was for me, and it's true for a lot of folks. And as for journalists, we all know, when you're giving out the numbers, they can sometimes be slippery. For more, here's Latino USA's senior producer, AC Valdez.
Let's turn first to a numbers expert and one-time vigilante.
Mr. Simpson, how do you respond to the charge that petty vandalism, such as graffiti, is down 80%, while heavy sack beatings are up a shocking 900%?
Oh, people can come up with statistics to prove anything, Kent. 40% of all people know that.
Just because stats are on TV or in the paper doesn't mean you should take them as gospel. But maybe you don't take cartoons seriously, so here's someone with more solid credentials.
Well, there's kind of a saying that's been floating around for many decades that says there are lies, damned lies, and statistics.
That's Guy Garcia. He's a numbers guy.
I'm the author of a book called The New Mainstream, and I'm the president of New Mainstream Initiatives at Ethnifax.
Ethnifax gathers numbers for companies that want to market their products more effectively to non-white and multicultural consumers. But I figured as someone who, for a living, keeps track of numbers, Guy could provide me with a little insight on how numbers in the media mislead us.
Statistics start from an assumption, usually, that can be married to data, but often reflect the bias of the people asking the questions, can also be distorted by the way the numbers are interpreted. And then finally, the presentation of the insights derived from statistics is fair game for just about anybody. You can have people looking at the same numbers and have a completely different interpretation.
Guy and I had a little chat before heading into the recording booth about the melting of Antarctica and climate change skeptics and, well, John Oliver's take.
Well, John Oliver was making fun of what I just said when he had someone coming out talking about climate and had a supposed scientist on his show saying that global warming was a fabrication, was not really true. And then, I don't know, 2 minutes into the show, you know, 50 scientists in lab coats came up onto the stage and just swamped the guy.
Joining me tonight, a climate change denier and naturally Bill Nye science guy. So, Bill.
Humans are causing climate change, no question.
Wait. Before we begin, in the interest of mathematical balance, I'm going to bring out two people who agree with you, climate skeptic. And Bill Nye, I'm also going to bring out 96 other scientists. It's a little unwieldy, but this is the only way you can actually have a representative discussion. Please file in. Again, this is going to make the debate difficult. We shouldn't really be having it in the first place.
The point he was making, which is true, is that the media is complicit in this kind of misleading of facts when often we know this has happened. A study is commissioned by an oil company, and the study concludes that global warming is exaggerated or non-existent. And then it's presented in the media alongside information that says global warming exists, and they're treated with equal weight.
So what does this matter to Latino USA? Well, let's say you're MTV.
Hey guys, it's Nicole Snooki Palizzi on assignment in London.
Previously on Teen Wolf, you essentially opened a door in your minds.
And you want to research your audience before piloting a new show. So you ask people, is being racially colorblind an aspirational goal? You might say that kind of question is a little leading. Of course, nobody wants racial differences to affect the way people are treated, but of course it does. So when a website like, say, Slate uses a stat focused solely on MTV viewers and takes it as representative of all millennials all over the country to conclude that millennials don't understand racism, well, let's just say media consumer beware.
I would just say you have to take statistics in context and don't rely on any one single source. And the most reliable statistics are usually composites of numbers that are coming from different sources that are accredited and have a history of being right on some level. So when a number pops up and you've never heard it before and it doesn't have any relationship to any other known statistical entity that has a solid reputation, you should look at that very warily.
So before you buy into the next trend piece or Upworthy video, even the figures we give you here on Latino USA, do a little digging elsewhere. You never know what you'll find. For Latino USA, I'm senior producer AC Valdez.
And now, mis queridos, we're going to talk television. The 2013-2014 TV season is wrapping up, so we thought it would be a good idea to take a look at how Latinos fared on TV this year. Latino USA producer Daisy Rosario brings you our own report card on how different networks did this past TV year.
One of my absolute favorite shows this year was Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It's a Fox sitcom about the misadventures of the detectives and staff of the 99 precinct. The show stars Andy Samberg and Andre Brower. But once you start watching, you realize the show isn't just about these guys. This ensemble comedy stars one of the most diverse casts on network television.
I'd just like to say I am happy to be here with my family. My super weird family with two black dads and two Latina daughters and two white sons.
That's Detective Jake Peralta, as played by Samberg, giving a toast. When he says family, he means a figurative family, his work family. The two black dads are Brower, as the precinct's captain, and Terry Crews, who continues to be great in everything, as the sergeant. The two white sons are Samberg as goofball Detective Jake Peralta and the long-overlooked Joe Latrullio as Detective Boyle. And the two Latina daughters he's referring to are very capable detectives, played by two largely unknown Latina actresses. Melissa Fumero plays the uptight detective Amy Santiago. She's constantly in a neck-and-neck race with Peralta for who solves the most cases. But despite being good at her job, a running joke is how desperate she is for the approval of the new captain.
I do feel, however, the word choice could have been improved in spots. I mark them awk for awkward.
That was the best thing anyone's ever said to me.
I mark them awk for awkward.
It's advice. He's mentoring me. Yes!
And Stephanie Beatriz plays tough detective Rosa Diaz. And the thing about Diaz is, well, no one wants to mess with Diaz.
So you know about Rosa's anger incidents.
It's my birthday. I hate birthdays. If you wish me a happy birthday, I will punch you.
You're a funny little bird, Diaz. Happy birthday.
Diaz does what she wants. She's my favorite. It's not just one Latino or black character in the background. It's many characters with different neuroses, desires, goals, and points of view. Fox did pretty well with overall diversity this year. Shows like The Mindy Project, The New Girl, and Sleepy Hollow have non-white characters in major roles. So what grade do they deserve? Well, let me explain how I'm thinking about this. First, it's not just the amount of Latinos. I'm looking at general diversity and how those characters are portrayed. And second, I'm grading on a curve. Third, this is just for fun. So this year, Fox gets an A.
An A!
Next up is NBC, the channel with the sneakiest uses of Latinos. For example, on the show Parenthood, one couple adopts a Latino son, and actress Sarah Ramos plays a member of the Braverman family. Aubrey Plaza plays April Ludgate on Parks and Recreation. And friend of Latino USA, Al Madrigal, is on the sitcom About a Boy. He plays the best friend to the show's star. And he isn't a stereotype of Latino as the best friend. He's just the best friend. In this scene, Madrigal's character Andy is explaining to lead character Will why game night is so important in his house.
Stop this, Andy.
I don't care. All I care about is tonight going well. This is a rare opportunity for me to have sex.
What kind of game night is this?
It's the kind where Lori gets in a good mood. She's got a wine buzz going on. Grandparents have the kids all night. Then odd numbers. Odd numbers ruin the whole thing.
All right, I'll bring a date.
No prostitutes.
And then, of course, there's Law & Order SVU, which features two actors of Cuban descent. Danny Pino as Detective Nick Amaro, and Broadway star Raul Esparza as Assistant District Attorney Rafael Barba. With other shows like Chicago Fire and The Voice, NBC has the right idea, but there's still room for improvement. I'll give it a solid B.
Solid B.
Now CBS. It's the most successful of the major networks. But other than the procedurals, you know, the cop and legal dramas, there's almost no Latinos. And even on the procedurals, the main characters are white. except for LL Cool J on NCIS Los Angeles. CBS gets an F.
An F.
The last of the major networks is ABC. Sofia Vergara is the highest paid actress on television for her role as Gloria Pritchett on the hit show Modern Family. And Guillermo Diaz plays Huck on the popular show Scandal. Huck struggles with how much he enjoys killing people.
How my mouth has been dry for months, how I've been squirming and vibrating, and it wouldn't stop until the other night when everything just stopped and I wasn't thirsty anymore.
Factor in shows like Grey's Anatomy and Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and ABC's overall diversity is pretty good. But next season looks to be even better. ABC recently announced that it picked up three diverse shows for the fall. Fresh Off the Boat about an Asian family, Blackish about a Black family, and in a surprising move, they picked up Cristela, a show about a young Mexican-American woman juggling her professional life and her old-school family. It stars stand-up comedian Cristela Alonso.
Part of me worries that when you are a big-deal lawyer, you will be embarrassed by me.
Maud, don't be ridiculous. I'm already embarrassed by you.
So while next year looks to be even more diverse, this season ABC gets a solid B+.
B+.
But probably the most diverse show of the last year is only available online. Orange is the New Black is produced by and only available on Netflix. If you're unfamiliar, it's about a woman named Piper Chapman who gets sent to prison after committing a crime. And since it takes place in a women's prison, it focuses mostly on types of female characters rarely shown on TV. Within that are all the different groups of the prison, the Asians, the whites, the blacks, and the Latinas, or the Spanish mommies. We don't just see these characters in terms of how they interact with the white lead. We also see how the groups function internally, and we flash back to their pre-prison days. So it looks like we might see even more Latinos on TV starting this fall. But in the meantime, Orange is the New Black returns for its second season on June 6th. I know I'll be watching. For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
Our producer, Daisy Rosario, also put together a show recently centered around an interview that we did with Bill Cosby. Now, during that interview, Daisy jumped into the studio to tell Mr. Cosby about an important story and how his show helped to educate her family in a fascinating and remarkable way. So, for this week's Sabiduría, or Words of Wisdom, we have Daisy sharing that story with Mr. Cosby, and we get to hear his response.
Anybody who's watched as many episodes of The Cosby Show as I have will remember the episode where Theo's having a hard time in school and you figure out that he's dyslexic.
Theo, when you're called upon in class, do you have difficulty finding the correct words to express yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I know what I want to say, but I have a hard time getting it straight in my mind.
Look, he's got it. Let's fix it.
When I was watching it one day, I think I was visiting from NYU, so I had started at college. And my mom and I were talking so much about what a hard time she'd had in school because she was so proud of me being at NYU. And I'm watching this episode and I'm like, you know, everything that Theo is saying on this episode sounds like my mother because she's so clearly a bright person. But she would get so shy talking to people because she had such a hard time expressing herself. And I'm watching this rerun, having seen it before, and I'm like, Mom, I think, what if you're dyslexic? I think you might be. And she was like, what is that?
He has the brain power. He just has a glitch in the way he takes in information.
A glitch?
Yes, he just has a problem in the way that he processes language.
And sure enough, it turns out that she's dyslexic. And at this point in her life, she had never read a book. She just found it too difficult. And she gets a little bit of help and she starts reading. And then she ended up going back to school at the same time that I was in college. And she started taking college courses and she ended up getting a degree. Mm. And so we were in school at the same time. She had always looked at me as like, oh, you're the one who's going to be educated. And she finally was able to step up and do something for herself too. So that's, we both always think of that change as coming from just being able to watch that episode. I've always wanted to be able to tell you that. So thank you.
When Ennis, who guided us as much as the person who said, go to this particular school, he went because he was tired of thinking that he knew it and then getting the results back a C minus or a C when he thought he aced something. I don't know what happened with your mother, but I will tell you this. It's in that show with Theo, because when Theo came home after the exam to find out what the problem was, and he said, I'm dyslexic, a cheer went up. My wife and I, Camille and I, cheered, and Ennis smiled, and we hugged each other, and he said, I'm not stupid, I'm dyslexic.
Hi.
Hey. Mr. Roscoe gave me the test results back.
And?
What did she say? You guys, I'm dyslexic.
And he went on to learn how he learns.
Exactly.
Now, your mother has probably come to you with her finger on something in a book. Listen to this. Listen to this. Okay, here's an article in the newspaper. Sit down. I want you to hear this.
I got asked about a lot of books I never read. Yeah. She'd be like, have you ever read this? I've never read this one. Well, you should read this one. Yes.
Right. And now you're sorry she even got it. And Ma, can't you go back to the old ways when you knew nothing? But it's absolutely fantastic. And I'm so happy that you saw the DVD, because I do want people to know we always have a way to reach back, but all we have to do is just speak.
That's just about it for this week, mis queridos. But before we go, I want to send out some goodbyes. First of all, lots of love to our colleagues at NPR's Tell Me More with Michelle Martin, which will cease production as of August. We're sad to see you go, and Michelle Martin, we look forward to hearing your dynamic and important voice on NPR. So for all of us from Latino USA to the wonderful team at Tell Me More, adios. And we say goodbye to our querida Tejana Brenda Salinas. Brenda brought you wonderful stories from eating disorders and Latinos to our hair, to making me run my first ever race. We are happy you get to go back to your familia and your state, mi querida Brenda, but we will miss you, our social media diva. Thank you so much. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, and Camilo Vargas. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to reporters Julia Duba, Dylan Pierce McCoy, and Roger McDonough for their help with our in-state tuition piece. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on Tumblr. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Thank you.
Hey. Hey.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.